Hello, I'd like to welcome you to this LexisNexis webinar on judicial review. I'm Nusrat Zahr and I'm a partner in the public law team at Herbert Smith Freehills.
And I'm Hugh Gunson and I head up the tax disputes and investigations team at Charles Russell Speechley's.
And our webinar today is going to consider some of the current hot topics and developments arising in the world of judicial review with particular relevance and reference to recent case law. Hugh and I are going to be covering six topics between us on this particular area. I'm going to be kicking off with the duty to consult and then human rights in judicial review.
I'm then going to talk about recent cases on challenges to tax legislation on human rights grounds.
I'll follow up on the role of public law in private contracts.
And then I'll finish with some discussion of recent tax cases on legitimate expectation, and finally, judicial review as an alternative means of challenge to the revenue.
Thanks, Hugh. So I'll be kicking off with the duty to consult. And the first topic, the duty to consult, really applies to public authorities in certain circumstances, and which forms part of the broader duty to act fairly in the exercise of their functions. In some circumstances, the way in which a consultation is carried out will be prescribed by statute, but there are a number of situations where there's no prescription by statute and the public body is instead expected to comply with implied common law rules of procedural fairness to consult. And the requirements of what a consultation should entail from a legal perspective are really all about what fairness requires in a particular context and are therefore very case law specific. So what I'm going to do in the next few minutes is talk about three recent cases where the courts have cast a light in the last year or so on what fairness requires in the context of a consultation. The first case I'm going to be talking about is British Gas Trading and Ofgem, which is a decision from last year. And what happened in this case is that the claimant, British Gas, successfully judicially reviewed a decision of Ofgem, and the case was really all about a challenge to the level of a price cap set by Ofgem on certain tariffs for the retail supply of domestic energy. The court found in this case that Ofgem had based its calculations on an incorrect assumption, and that was what had led to an unfair consultation and amounted to a mistake of fact. The background to the challenge was the introduction a couple of years ago by Ofgem of an obligation to set and implement a price cap on certain tariffs for the retail supply of domestic energy. And this was really all with a view to protecting domestic customers on default tariffs. In setting the level of the cap, Ofgem was required to have regard to certain needs, including the need to ensure that suppliers were able to finance their activities. What Ofgem did in this situation was that prior to introducing the cap, it ran a consultation and asked stakeholders about the design of the cap. And following the consultation process and the setting of the cap, British Gas went on to challenge by way of judicial review Ofgem's assessment of a particular element used to calculate the price cap, arguing that it was based on an incorrect assumption about the supplier's behaviour. The court accepted British Gas's criticism of the approach taken by Ofgem in setting the price cap and found that British Gas was entitled to declaratory relief, which really required Ofgem to reconsider the calculation and make appropriate adjustments. I think the key element for our purposes with this case is that when considering consultation requirements, what the court found here was that Ofgem had relied on an incorrect assumption, and that assumption was not communicated to consultees during the consultation process or otherwise. So it was not obvious to consultees on the face of the consultation papers that there was this assumption in place, and the supplier's evidence was that they had no knowledge of it, meaning that they just couldn't correct it during the consultation process. This was clearly problematic when assessing the fairness of the consultation, as the process has to allow participants to address the issue before a final decision is made. And particularly relevant here, I think, was the common law requirement to provide consultees with sufficient information to enable them to put together an intelligent response. I think there's two takeaways for us from this particular judgment. One, a reminder to public bodies that it's essential to communicate all relevant material information to consultation participants to allow them to address key issues. And secondly, a reminder to participants that they do need to address any assumptions in a consultation that are evident from the consultation papers, even if views on them aren't expressly required by the entity that's consulting. The second case I'm going to be turning to on consultation is another recent case from last year. It's called Electronic Collars Manufacturers Association and DEFRA. And this was a High Court decision where the High Court rejected a claim for judicial review of a decision by DEFRA to ban the use of remote controlled shock collars for cats and dogs, which are also known as e-collars. The previous policy had been that there was insufficient evidence to justify a ban, but a consultation was carried out by DEFRA a couple of years ago, which received over 7,000 responses. And on the back of that consultation, DEFRA took the decision to ban e-collars. The claimants in the judicial review were e-collar manufacturers, and they argued that the Secretary of State here had effectively predetermined the merits of the decision to ban before the consultation was completed, and that therefore the decision to ban was unlawful because the consultation did not take place at a formative stage. Indeed, the court did recognise that there were a number of weaknesses in the DEFRA consultation document. For example, it narrowly stated certain scientific research. But whilst recognising that the consultation process and paper was far from perfect, the court did decide that the deficiencies didn't cause the overall decision to ban to be so unfair as to be unlawful. And in reaching this decision, the court did look at the seminal case in the area of consultation of Ex parte Coughlin, which I've referred to on the slide. And in particular, it took note of the four key elements to ensure a fair consultation, which are set out in that case. Firstly, that consultation must be undertaken at a time when proposals are still at a formative stage. Secondly, that sufficient reasons do have to be given for proposals to allow consultees to give intelligent consideration and responses. Thirdly, that adequate time must be given for this purpose. And finally, that the product of the consultation has to be conscientiously taken into account when the ultimate decision is taken. So although on this occasion, in this case, the claimant was unsuccessful, I think the case is overall still significant as a reminder that the timing of running a consultation process is absolutely key. The third and final case I'm going to be talking about in the context of consultations is another case from last year, and it's called British Blind and Shutter Association and Secretary of State for Housing, Local Communities and Local Government. This again was a High Court decision, and it was all about a successful judicial review challenge brought by the claimants, the British Blind and Shutter Association, against a decision of the Secretary of State as a result of an unfair consultation. And what happened here was that a decision was taken by the Secretary of State to include external blinds, shutters and awnings in a ban on the use of combustible materials in cladding systems on high-rise residential buildings in response to the Grenfell Tower fire. The government commenced a consultation following the Grenfell fire and published a consultation paper on the proposed ban on consultation materials. The claimant association here didn't respond to the consultation paper because they didn't believe that it was relevant to them, as their members did not manufacture combustible materials. But following the introduction of secondary legislation, the claimants realised that actually the new regulations did have the effect of banning the use of their product on relevant buildings if the materials didn't meet the required standard. And the claimant's uncontested evidence was that it wasn't currently possible for them to manufacture any fabrics for the products sold by their members which actually met this required standard. What the court said here was, first, they accepted that the claimant association was a statutory consultee and as such should have been specifically notified about the consultation. the Secretary of State had not actually taken any steps here to specifically bring the consultation to the attention of the association and its members. But nonetheless, the court concluded that steps taken to publicise the consultation more generally, for example, publishing the fact of the consultation on the government website and referring to it in Parliament, were sufficient to bring the consultation paper to the attention of the claimants and their members. However, the court then went on to look at the adequacy of the consultation and concluded that the degree of specificity with which the public body should conduct its consultation, bearing in mind that the demands of fairness are likely to be higher when a public body contemplates depriving somebody of an existing benefit or advantage, did mean that there had been unfairness here amounting to unlawfulness. The court concluded that the consultation paper here didn't actually tell the claimants in clear terms that their proposal was to extend the ban to external blinds, shutters and awnings. And so for this reason, the court concluded that the consultation failed to comply with the requirement to let those who have a potential interest in the subject matter know in clear terms what that proposal is. And so the consultation was held to be unlawful.
So, Nizrat, the question I have from all of that is when might a duty to reconsult actually arise?
Yeah, I think a duty to reconsult can arise in two particular situations. First, I think where new information comes to light to the body consulting, either during the course of the consultation or just after the consultation, or where the body that's consulting itself decides that it's going to take a slightly different approach or make a different decision to the minded to decision which it set out in the actual consultation paper. And I think if either of those two factual scenarios exist, either new material coming to light or the body concerned deciding it's actually going to take a slightly different approach, I think in that type of situation, a common law duty to reconsult probably does arise, and there's then a risk of a potential judicial review challenge if a consultation isn't carried out.
Thank you.
I'm going to be turning next to our second topic, and this is all about human rights in judicial review. I'm going to be looking in particular at two very, very recent cases relating to judicial review and human rights, which have emanated from the Supreme Court in the last 12 months. And the first case is RR and Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. This was a decision of the Supreme Court from late last year, and it was the latest in quite a long line of judicial review cases relating to regulations governing the removal of the spare room subsidy for people in social housing, which is more commonly referred to as the bedroom tax. This case, however, is likely to have repercussions well beyond the welfare benefits context, as it clearly sets out how local authorities and tribunals should deal with situations where domestic secondary legislation is in conflict with convention rights and the Human Rights Act. So, turning first to what the bedroom tax is, it's effectively a percentage reduction in housing benefit if the number of bedrooms in social sector properties exceed a certain defined number, and that's calculated in line with housing benefit regulations. What happened by way of context to this particular case is that in 2016, the Supreme Court, in a case called Carmichael and Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, held that aspects of these regulations, which determine the percentage reduction, had led to unjustified discrimination on the ground of disability. And the relief granted by the Supreme Court in Carmichael was a declaration that the claimant had suffered discrimination contrary to Article 14 of the European Convention on Human Rights. So in response to this adverse decision, the Secretary of State subsequently introduced amended regulations which were intended to cater for instances in which the Supreme Court had held that the previous regulations had led to violations of the Convention on Human Rights. And these amended regulations came into force in April 2017. The problem, however, was that these new regulations were not retrospective. So there were a number of cases extant before local authorities and tribunals that related to the interim period before the amended regulations came into force. And the key question for the Supreme Court in RR was really the effect of the court's decision in Carmichael on local authorities and tribunals having to deal with cases in this interim period. And really, local authorities and tribunals were faced with a binary choice in respect of how to deal with cases. They could either first apply the regulations in their original form, albeit that by doing so, they would then be a breach of convention rights. Or secondly, they could calculate housing benefit without applying the reduction by effectively ignoring the aspects of the regulations that the Supreme Court had found unlawful. The Supreme Court here favoured the second approach and found that there's nothing unconstitutional about a public authority disapplying a provision of secondary legislation which would otherwise result in their acting incompatibly with a convention right where this is necessary to comply with the Human Rights Act. And in reaching this decision, the court relied upon the distinction between primary legislation and secondary legislation in the Human Rights Act itself. So under the Act, it's very clear that it's unlawful for a public authority to act in a way which is incompatible with a convention right. But there is an exception in Section 6(2) of the Act if the public authority is compelled to act in a certain way because of another piece of primary legislation. However, the court noted that there is no such exception in respect of secondary legislation, such as the housing benefit regulations here. And the court also noted a number of English cases which have held that a provision of subordinate legislation which results in a breach of a convention right does have to be disregarded. What I think this decision of the Supreme Court does is to reaffirm the primacy of Acts of Parliament and in particular the primacy of the requirements of the Human Rights Act. And I think this might be particularly relevant looking slightly ahead over the next few months as the government introduces what are likely to be a raft of secondary instruments to regulate Britain's exit from the European Union. And indeed, I think this judgment might act as a very important procedural safeguard against any new secondary instruments which might be deemed to be incompatible with the Human Rights Act and the European Convention on Human Rights. The second case I'm going to be talking about in the context of human rights is another Supreme Court decision called Lee and Ashes Baking, and this is a decision from late 2018. This was a case from Northern Ireland which concerned the lawfulness of a refusal by a bakery to ice the message "support gay marriage" onto a cake on the grounds that gay marriage was contrary to their deeply held Christian religious beliefs. The claimant here, Mr. Lee, had brought proceedings in the county court alleging direct and indirect discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation, religious belief or political opinion in breach of Articles 9, 10 and 14 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And by the time this case reached the Supreme Court, it was accepted that if there was discrimination, it was direct. However, the bakery, Ashes, argued that the relevant equality legislation should be read down to accommodate their human rights to freedom of expression and freedom of religion under Articles 9 and 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights. The Supreme Court here said that there was no discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation, and Lady Hale, who delivered the judgment, was very clear that she relied on the finding of the district judge that the bakery would have refused to ice the message of support for gay marriage, whoever had asked for it, regardless of their sexual orientation. It was, however, necessary for the Supreme Court to go on to balance the bakery owner's convention rights against Mr. Lee's convention rights in the sense of freedom of political belief. The court found in favour of the bakery. It emphasised that what was at stake here was whether the state could compel the bakery to express a political opinion, that is, support for gay marriage, which they disagreed with for religious reasons. And as well as protecting the right to hold or express certain beliefs, the court here emphasised that the convention and common law also protected the right not to hold and not to express a political opinion or a religious belief, and that no one could be compelled to express a particular opinion with which they disagreed. So on the one hand, the bakery could not refuse to supply a cake to a person because of that person's sexual orientation or political or religious belief, but the state could not compel the bakery to express a particular political opinion or religious belief by icing a message on that cake. I think this case is particularly interesting as the Supreme Court took a very expansive view of the interpretation of Articles 9 and 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights to include both positive and negative rights. That is, a right not to hold or express a belief, as well as the right to hold or express particular beliefs.
So, Nusrat, thank you. One question that I have, and I imagine will be on many people's lips currently, is will Brexit have any impact on the application of human rights law in the UK?
Yes, and I don't think Brexit will have a direct impact on the application of human rights because we have the Human Rights Act enshrined in domestic legislation, and we also have the European Convention on Human Rights, which is quite separate to Brexit and the UK exiting the EU, and the Human Rights Act and the European Convention will still continue in existence, and we will very much be subject to those provisions. I think the main change to bear in mind is that with our exit from the EU, we will come out of the European Charter on Fundamental Rights, and that contains a few human rights which are not enshrined in the Human Rights Act, such as the rights of the child and a self-standing right of non-discrimination. So I think that's the most likely direct impact which Brexit will have on human rights in the UK.
Okay, thank you.
Hugh.
Yeah, thank you, Nusrat. So I'm now going to speak about recent challenges to tax legislation on human rights grounds, in particular under Article 1 to the First Protocol, which I'm going to refer to as A1P1. It's fair to say that recently there has been an increase in judicial review challenges to tax legislation on A1P1 grounds. Typically, this happens where the legislation has or is perceived to have an element of retrospectivity. The argument generally goes that a taxpayer's money or funds is a possession, the peaceful enjoyment of which is being interfered with in contravention of A1P1 by the imposition of a tax. It is worth noting in this context the sort of proviso in the second paragraph of A1P1, which says that the right to peaceful enjoyment of possessions does not impair the right of the state to enforce laws as it deems necessary to control the use of property in accordance with general interest, or importantly, to secure the payment of taxes. And that's often referred to in the case law. The first case I'm going to talk about briefly is a case called Roe, which the details of which I'm not going to go into now because I'm going to come on to talk about it in a different context later on in the webinar. But very broadly, that was a judicial review challenge to the issue of what are called accelerated payment notices, or APNs, to taxpayers who had entered into film partnership schemes. What an APN does, again, very broadly, is that where certain conditions are met, it allows the revenue, HMRC, to issue a notice that effectively reverses the usual economic position on tax appeals. So rather than the taxpayer being able to postpone payment of tax while the appeal is being determined through the courts, once an APN is issued, the disputed tax needs to be paid up front, i.e. the taxpayer has to pay to play. In the Roe case, a lot was made of the fact that the transactions in question had been entered into before that legislation was enacted. However, the human rights challenges failed. What the Court of Appeal held was that the APN regime was entirely accessible, clear, and foreseeable in effect. In terms of retrospectivity, the risk for the taxpayer who entered into the transactions in question was whether they would have to pay tax at all, not when they would have to pay, which is ultimately what an APN did. The court also considered that it was proportionate for the government to seek to change the economics of marketed tax avoidance schemes. In areas of tax, states have a wide margin of appreciation, and the public authority is better placed than the courts to determine how the broad interests of the community and the individual are to be balanced. One interesting point, which I'll come on to talk about in more detail a bit later on, is that the Court of Appeal did leave open the question of whether A1P1 was in fact engaged at all, so whether the taxpayer's money that was required to be paid under the APN was in fact a possession. The point here really boils down to whether, at the time the notices were issued, the fact that the money was impressed with an arguable claim by the revenue prevented it from being a possession. And there's some earlier case law that goes into that point. The Court of Appeal did draw attention to the fact that under the APN regime, those notices can be served during an inquiry process, so before the revenue has even made an assessment or a formal demand for the tax. But ultimately, it left the position to be decided for another case. The second case that I'm going to talk about is a more recent one in the context of a recent measure introduced that's generated a lot of publicity called the loan charge. As you may be aware, this was introduced, again, very broadly, to tax historic disguised remuneration arrangements, which broadly involved paying remuneration via a third party by way of loans that were never expected to be repaid, with a view to those loans not being taxable by the recipient. As originally enacted, this legislation applied to all such loans made since 1999 that were still outstanding, i.e. that had not been repaid, as at the 5th of April 2019. And there was heavy criticism in a number of quarters for the retrospectivity or retroactivity of that measure. Various challenges, I'm aware, have been launched on A1, P1 grounds. The particular one I'm going to talk about, the reported case, which is called Cartref Care Home Limited and others, but I am aware that other slightly different challenges have also been brought. I suppose the first point here is the challenge ultimately failed, but there are a number of interesting points that were discussed and explored in the judgment. There was again an interesting discussion on whether A1 P1 was in fact engaged at all. Was the money in that case subject to a claim by HMRC? And it's interesting here that there were a number of different claimants in the case, and the court took a different approach to the different types of claimants. This involved something of a detailed look through the legislative history and the warnings given by the revenue. They didn't like these type of arrangements, and the certainty of the position at the time the relevant taxpayers' arrangements were actually entered into. So for some claimants, broadly, it was obvious that their scheme or their arrangement did not work when they'd entered into it. So they had no possession, and therefore A1 P1 was not engaged. But it was different for Cartref, one of the claimants, the one named on the slide. The scheme that they had entered into was different to those HMRC were known to disapprove of, and so they were held to have a possession for these purposes, and therefore A1 P1 was engaged. In any event, however, the challenge failed. The court considered the main question really was the interference with the taxpayer's possession reasonable or proportionate? The state has a wide margin of appreciation, particularly in a tax context, and what it all comes down to really is a question of fair balance. The scheme that the taxpayer entered into was held to be tax avoidance, and the court said there was a legitimate public policy objective of discouraging tax avoidance. The legislation also wasn't unsignaled, but it followed a consultation process in the background of broad concerns that have been raised around the taxation of remuneration, and in particular concerns around disguised remuneration arrangements. The court found that at the time of the arrangements, a typical well-informed taxpayer should have been on risk that tax avoidance was likely to be challenged, even if it was not the case that the money was so similar to other schemes that it was held to be impressed with a claim by HMRC. That's quite a subtle point of distinction there, but the court felt able to make it. The court also noted that retrospective legislation is acceptable for tax avoidance schemes. It did, however, pause on the extent of the retrospectivity in this case. As I mentioned, it goes back pretty much 20 years, back to a time before warnings were really given by the revenue that they disapproved of these arrangements. However, in this case, the claimants weren't actually from those early years. They had entered into the schemes at a later time, and the court did not have any evidence from people who had done things at the beginning of the 20-year period. So overall, the challenge failed. The court found that the legislative approach was not illegitimate or without reasonable foundation. it didn't, whether or not a less intrusive measure could have been used, which it did not decide, the court found there was insufficient proper evidential basis for it to conclude otherwise. Subsequent to that decision, there has been a review of the loan charge, which has resulted in changes, which in particular go to the retrospectivity. So that it now only applies to loans made from 2010 onwards. And one might query the impact that would have on either an appeal in this case or other challenges.
Yeah, thanks very much for that, Hugh. And one question I've got is, following on from the cases you've mentioned, do you think it is ever possible to successfully challenge tax legislation on human rights type grounds?
Yeah, thanks, Nisra. That's a fair question. I think it's fair to say it's clearly very difficult, but I don't think it's impossible, particularly given that in recent years tax legislation is becoming more and more severe, often with more draconian consequences. There's a perception that sometimes new legislation removes taxpayer rights. And so I think it's not impossible to conceive that a new measure, like the loan charge or something different, might be susceptible to this sort of challenge. In that regard, I would note that the level of retrospectivity did seem to trouble the court in the Cartref case. But ultimately, as I said, the evidence in that case just wasn't there. I suppose it's interesting to speculate on what might have happened had there been evidence from the early years, and whether what approach the court would have taken. So I think it's definitely worth bearing in mind in the right case.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Hugh. We're going to turn next to our fourth topic on this webinar, and that's all about the interaction of private and public law, in particular in the context of public law bodies entering into private contracts. And I'm going to be talking about a Privy Council case from last year, which is called Mauritius and CT Power Limited. CT Power, in this case, had been working in Mauritius to construct a new electricity generating plant for Mauritius. And before commencing the project, it was obliged to obtain what was known as an environmental impact assessment licence. The licence was issued to it subject to certain conditions, including a requirement for the company, CT Power, to prove its financial capabilities for the duration of the project to the satisfaction of its ultimate customer, the Ministry of Finance. Separately, it was also a condition of CT Power's agreement with its eventual customer that the agreement would only come into force once CT Power had put in place a separate implementation agreement with the Ministry of Energy. And the final terms of this implementation agreement were not agreed, and it was never signed. CT Power went on to apply for judicial review of both the Ministry of Finance's decision that the condition of the licence hadn't been satisfied, and also the Ministry of Energy's decision not to sign the implementation agreement. The case went to the Mauritian Supreme Court, which found that both decisions by both ministries were amenable to judicial review, and that the decisions were unreasonable, irrational, and in breach of CT Power's legitimate expectations. The case then went on appeal to the Privy Council, and the Privy Council agreed with the Mauritian Supreme Court that both decisions were indeed amenable to judicial review, and that public bodies were still required to comply with common law public law principles when negotiating commercial agreements in the private law context. However, in this case, the Privy Council quashed the decision of the Mauritian Supreme Court on the basis that the public authorities in question here had acted in accordance with public law principles when negotiating the CT Power contract. And what the court said here was that the first decision, this was the Ministry of Finance's decision that the condition hadn't been satisfied by CT Power, the Privy Council here said that that decision did fall within its public duty to ensure adherence with the licence, which was a regulatory instrument. And with regard to the second decision, the Ministry of Energy's decision as to whether or not to sign the implementation agreement, the Privy Council considered that where the proposed party to a contract was a public authority, it wasn't entirely free from constraints arising under public law. I think this case is interesting because it demonstrates that even where a public body is carrying out a commercial function, public law principles still do apply to the performance of that function. And this was even in circumstances where a clause of the draft implementation agreement here expressly said that related decisions were not amenable to judicial review. The court, however, rejected the existence of that clause and still thought that public law would apply to the entry into that particular agreement. So whilst public bodies are expected to act in accordance with public law principles, this should by no means deter them from entering into commercial contracts, in that public bodies will still generally be awarded a very wide margin of discretion when entering into and complying with obligations in commercial contracts. And the CT Power case is a very good example of that. I think really the case shows that only claims involving very severe instances of bad faith amounting to fraud or corruption or some other type of bad faith are likely to be successful in this context and to amount to a clear breach of public law.
Thank you, Nusrat. A question I had was, what does the Mauritius judgment mean for public and private law remedies? Would both be available to a claimant in a given case?
Yes, I think the short answer is that yes, both types of remedy would be available and they would coexist side by side. I think the starting point for a court when looking at remedies is looking at the vehicle by which the claim has been brought. Is it a judicial review or is it some other type of civil claim? But if in theory both claims have been brought by a challenger, then in principle they should be entitled to both types of remedy, subject of course to complying with the very different limitation periods that apply to public law claims and private law claims.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thank you. And thank you very much. I'm now going to talk about an issue that's come up quite a lot in recent years in the tax context, which is judicial review on the grounds of a breach of legitimate expectation. What I thought it might be helpful to do at the outset is just to set out a brief background on how it actually does arise in the tax context. Broadly, a claim for judicial review on grounds of a breach of legitimate expectation requires three things. First, that a taxpayer has an expectation of a particular treatment by HMRC as a result of HMRC's words or conduct. So typically that would be published guidance or a specific ruling in response to a clearance application. Second, that expectation is legitimate. And third, that it would be unjust for HMRC to frustrate the claimant's expectation. So a typical judicial review situation would involve HMRC seeking to assess tax on a taxpayer in a manner that is contrary to their published guidance or to a ruling that they've previously given. As you may be aware, HMRC do publish detailed guidance on many points in their manuals available on their website and in other publications, which taxpayers do rely on a lot in practice. And the question then arises is that if the revenue change their mind, which they do, can those statements actually be relied on? There's often a tension there between the taxpayer's expectation on the one hand, as opposed to the general expectation of being taxed only in accordance with the law rather than in accordance with what the revenues say, and the sort of overriding public interest in that latter point. The focus in these cases is often on the nature of the statement that's made, must be clear, unambiguous and devoid of relevant qualification, as per the MFK underwriting case that I've referred to on the slide. And in circumstances where a taxpayer requests a clearance or a ruling to even get off the ground on this, he or she must have put all their cards face upwards on the table. So with that background in mind, I am just going to talk now about three recent cases in the legitimate expectation context. The first one is a case called Vacation Rentals and HMRC. This is a decision of the Upper Tribunal Tax Chamber and is a taxpayer success. I'm not going to go into the technical details, but broadly it concerned the VAT treatment of credit or debit card handling fees, and HMRC had published guidance on this in a standalone business brief document following an ECJ decision. However, HMRC subsequently sought to resile from that guidance. And the main focus of the decision was on a point that's quite important in this sort of context, which is whether actually the taxpayer had fallen specifically within the terms of the guidance rather than just on some sort of general level. The revenue said that it hadn't, but the Upper Tribunal found that in this case the taxpayer was squarely within the terms of the revenue's published guidance. A few other points that were discussed: the fact that the taxpayer was sophisticated with access to legal advice was not particularly relevant in this case, So the court concluded that there was a legitimate expectation and HMRC hadn't come close to justifying why it should be overridden. So the taxpayer was able to succeed in challenging the assessment. The second case I'm going to talk about is a case called Aozora GMAC Investment Limited, which is a decision of the Court of Appeal and which the taxpayer lost. This case concerned a statement in an HMRC manual, so a manual published on HMRC's website. And without going into the details, that statement was as to the effect of a particular legislative provision within one of the Taxes Acts about the application of the UK's tax treaties. Broadly, that for that legislative provision, that only applied to one specific provision of the US-UK double tax treaty. Subsequent to that, HMRC then sought to charge tax on the taxpayer contrary to the terms of their guidance. It was found that there was a clear and unambiguous representation in the manual, so it was sufficient to found the legitimate expectation. And the decision really focused on whether there was sufficient unfairness to prevent what was in essence a public body, i.e. HMRC, correcting a policy error. For this, the unfairness had to be outrageous or conspicuous, is the language that the Court of Appeal used. So that seems to have set really quite a high bar. However, there are a number of factors to note in that context. There was a discussion as to whether the relevance of detrimental reliance, i.e. did the taxpayer rely on HMRC's guidance to its detriment. This wasn't essential, but it is a powerful factor in deciding whether the conspicuous unfairness is made out. The Court of Appeal rejected a suggestion from the Revenue that the fact that the taxpayer had procured advice and that it was the advisor who had actually relied on the guidance rather than the taxpayer himself was fatal to the claim. That wasn't the case. However, the use by the taxpayer of an external advisor was not irrelevant, in particular where the representation was simply a statement of what the law is, since if you engage a specialist advisor, they might have their own view and they can work it out for themselves. And the Court of Appeal drew a distinction between a statement, a sort of plain statement of the law, as opposed to a statement by HMRC as to how they interpret what are in sort of inherently uncertain terms or the criteria according to which they will exercise their discretion. On the facts, therefore, any reliance placed on this guidance was weak because, first of all, the representation was as to HMRC's opinion on the law, and secondly, that the taxpayer sought and obtained specialist advice on the meaning of the legal provision in question. So, in conclusion, HMRC were allowed to resile from their guidance and the taxpayer lost the judicial review challenge. The third case I'm going to talk about just briefly is a case called Cobalt Data Centre 2 LLP and others. Again, this is a decision of the Upper Tribunal Tax Chamber, and it's a taxpayer success. I won't go into the facts here again, but the case concerned the availability of something called enterprise zone allowances, which very broadly is a regime designed to provide tax breaks for investment in disadvantaged areas. The interesting point here is that the representation in question, on which the legitimate expectation was founded, wasn't in generally published guidance or a specific ruling, but actually it was in a set of correspondence between HMRC and an industry trade body. And it was relevant here that HMRC were aware that the group with whom it was corresponding was a trade body and that the whole purpose of that correspondence was for it to be relied on by taxpayers such as those in the appeal, i.e. investors and enterprise zones. And HMRC also had an interest in that correspondence. An important aim of the regime in question was to stimulate investment in areas perceived as disadvantaged, and as a government department, HMRC wanted to ensure that the necessary sort of fiscal stimulus was delivered, while at the same time avoiding undue risk to the Exchequer through the abuse of that relief. It was further the court noted that the point that the Revenue had agreed in correspondence was not clearly wrong. The Revenue were acting within their managerial discretion as to how the enterprise zone allowance regime should be administered. So taking into account all of that, there was a legitimate expectation for the taxpayer that they were able to hold the Revenue to. And what I just thought I'd sort of try and draw some threads together from those three cases. I suppose it's worth noting that as a general point, it's fair to say there is a high threshold to succeed on a claim for judicial review on grounds of legitimate expectation in a tax context. Courts will often look back to the only expectation of a taxpayer is to be taxed in accordance with the law. Any taxpayers relying on HMRC guidance in particular for their tax treatment should be well aware of that, that if HMRC changed their mind, it may be difficult to hold them to it. However, it is very much possible. Two out of the three cases that I've just spoken about were wins for the taxpayer. They successfully held the revenue to their statements. I do struggle to reconcile the decisions. There are sort of inconsistencies in them in some respects, and it does seem that in different cases, different points have been argued, but common themes to look out for. Any claim of this nature will require quite a close analysis of the context in which the representation is made. Is it published guidance or is it a specific ruling? The nature of the representation, is it the revenue saying what they think the law is, or is it them saying how they will interpret particular terms or use their discretion in a particular context? The level of reliance on the statement is also relevant. The guidance often needs to be something the taxpayer has actually looked at and taken into account in its decision making. What the courts won't have much time for is someone subsequently trying to use a piece of revenue guidance as a kind of get out of jail free card if they haven't paid much heed to it at the time. And finally, the extent to which specialist advice is taken is also a relevant factor, sort of linked to the points I've just made. If you have an advisor who comes to their own conclusion without reference to the HMRC guidance, it's going to be difficult ultimately to rely on it.
Yeah, thanks very much for that, Hugh. That's really interesting. And one question I've got is, what would your advice be to taxpayers who are faced with an HMRC assessment, which does appear to be contrary to existing guidance or a ruling?
Well, that's a very good point. Thank you, Nusrat. I mean, in that case, it's important. It's critical to consider two different angles. First, is there a challenge on tax technical grounds to that assessment? But second, might there also be a claim for judicial review on grounds of a breach of legitimate expectation, which would involve a close analysis of those points I've just talked about? There are a number of cases that involve both, and there are. It's critical to note that there are different time limits for making an appeal against the tax assessment and launching a claim for judicial review. Taxpayers should be aware that also there would be a need to launch separate proceedings. A tax appeal would generally be made in the specialist tax tribunals, whereas a judicial review claim must be brought in the High Court.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Thank you, Nusrat. So moving on to the final section of this webinar, I've called this judicial review as an alternative means of appeal in the tax context. What I'm going to focus on here is the fact that in recent years, we've seen an increase in HMRC powers, often with draconian consequences, where the legislation specifically provides no right of appeal. There have, however, been a number of challenges to the exercise by the revenue of their powers by means of judicial review. So although there's no statutory right of appeal, often a challenge is made through the means of judicial review in a large number of cases. And what one sort of general thread that has arisen from the cases, even where the challenge has been unsuccessful, is that the way HMRC have been using their powers and the processes they have in place to implement them have been found to be lacking and below what the legislation had intended. The two main examples here are accelerated payment notices, so APNs or PPNs, and follower notices. I'll just explain up front very broadly what these are to set the context before I talk about a couple of cases. So first, accelerated payment notices. I've mentioned these already, but just to recap, notices that can be issued by HMRC in certain circumstances, usually in the context of tax avoidance arrangements, broadly reversing the normal position on tax appeals. So taxpayers have to pay disputed tax up front in order to launch an appeal, designed to shift the economic burden of the disputes. The regime does include a statutory right of representation, but that's only to HMRC on grounds that the relevant conditions for issuing the notice are not met. But fundamentally, once those representations are made, HMRC don't agree with the taxpayer, there is then no statutory right of appeal of that decision. Also, there's links to APNs of follower notices, again, broadly intended in the tax avoidance context. These apply where there is already a judicial ruling that is relevant, which is a defined term, to the case at hand. What that broadly means is that there is an existing judgment where if you applied the principles or reasoning in that judgment to the taxpayer's case, it would be determinative of their position. And this was designed to address a concern, particularly in the marketed tax avoidance context, where you'd have a wide number of taxpayers entering into the same arrangements. Only one would go to the tribunal and ultimately result in a decision, and other taxpayers would continue to challenge rather than necessarily being bound by what effectively what the first decision had concluded. And if a taxpayer gets a follower notice and continues with an appeal and is unsuccessful, then it's potentially subject to an additional financial penalty of up to 50% of the tax. Now, as an aside, it seems to me there are potentially sort of human rights grounds on the right to a fair trial there, but that's not what I'm going to talk about in this particular section. The issue of follower notice is also a condition for issuing an APN. And again, there's an inbuilt right of representation, but no appeal if HMRC don't change their mind. So the first case I'm going to talk about is a case I've mentioned earlier in the human rights context, which is a case called Roe, a judicial review challenge to a decision by HMRC to issue an APN or a PPN to a member of a film partnership scheme. The challenge was ultimately unsuccessful, but again, a number of interesting points arise out of the judgment. As part of the APN regime, there was a requirement that a particular designated officer of HMRC had to form the view that the tax scheme did not work, and the court found that for the notice to be valid, the HMRC officer needed to be positively satisfied that the scheme was ineffective, rather than just being of the view that there was a dispute. And that might seem like a subtle distinction, but actually it's potentially quite important in practice. That does set a materially higher threshold, a level of certainty for the revenue to have before issuing one of these quite penal notices. There was also some discussion of the policy adopted by the revenue around these notices. It wasn't wrong for the revenue to have a general policy for issuing APNs where a given set of criteria were met, provided that sufficient provision is made for cases which don't fall properly within it. It's sufficient in that regard that the legislative scheme provides for disclosure to the revenue and an opportunity to make representations. But what the court said is that policy, the revenue can't, by means of a general policy, override the function of that designated officer that I've already mentioned, who the court found needed to form a view on the scheme itself. There was also an argument on retrospectivity, but that found sort of short shrift with the court. It was clear from the words of the legislation that it could apply to the case at hand. So again, that challenge failed. Moving on, the second case and final case I'm going to talk about is a case about a follower notice called Howarth. This is a judicial review of a follower notice to a participant in what's colloquially known as a round the world scheme. And this referred to a previous judicial ruling, which was a decision of the Court of Appeal in a case called Smallwood. In this case, the taxpayer was successful in actually having that follower notice quashed. Again, there was a debate around the level of confidence in the underlying technical tax treatment that HMRC needed to be able to issue and to be able to use these strong powers that had been granted to it. The Court of Appeal found that HMRC needed a substantial degree of confidence that precedent decision would actually apply to the taxpayer's facts, rather than just it would be more likely than not to do so. So again, common with the Roe case, the revenue were found to be applying the wrong threshold to exercise these powers. The Court of Appeal said that these are strong powers intended only to be used in relatively exceptional circumstances. And what the revenue had done is misdirected themselves in a couple of different ways. First, they'd overstated the conclusions in the previous ruling. So on a close reading, the Court of Appeal decision in Smallwood didn't set out a given set of factors which, if they are met, meant that an arrangement failed, but rather the decision in that case was that it was open to the first instance court to make the decision that they did on the facts, which is obviously quite a lot. That is quite a different conclusion. Secondly, the revenue were found to have misdirected themselves for not having a sufficient degree of certainty as to the outcome. So taking all that together, the Court of Appeal said, well, it couldn't be said that HMRC would have arrived at the same conclusion even if they hadn't misdirected themselves. They might have done, but that was by no means self-evident. So ultimately, taxpayer was successful, the following notice was quashed. I do just note that in the last few weeks, I did see that the Revenue have recently been given permission to appeal that decision to the Supreme Court. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Thanks very much, Hugh. And do you think cases like Howarth will lead the HMRC to look at their powers to issue follower notices and issue them more sparingly?
Again, that's a good question. I mean, as I've sort of spoken about, the Court of Appeal was clear that these are strong powers to be used in you know, relatively limited or relatively exceptional cases. And what they do is they require a high degree of certainty as to the underlying tax position before they can use them. So in that light, one would hope so. I can't say I've seen any actual change on the ground, however. And what I am particularly interested to see is the Supreme Court's take on it, if the case, assuming the case progresses. That'll certainly be interesting, and one would hope that would shape the Revenue's attitude to these sort of things going forward. So I suppose essentially it's a bit of a watch this space.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Hugh. Well, that concludes our webinar on judicial review, and all that remains to say is thank you very much for joining us. I would also add that this webinar is designed to help solicitors meet requirements A2 and A4 of the SRA Statement of Solicitor Competence. And you can also take our quiz, which can be accessed via the Take a Quiz link on the webinar details page to reinforce your understanding of the content of this webinar. And the way that the quiz works is that you have to answer 7 out of 10 questions correctly, and you have 2 attempts at the quiz. Please do submit any feedback via the survey screen. And please note that this webinar will be archived immediately, and it will be available to view on demand for 24 months. A transcript of the webinar is also available on request. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.